Welcome to All Analytics Radio. This is Jim Connolly. I'm editor of allanalytics.com. Topics relating to robots, machine learning, and other AI-related technologies have grown a lot of attention on A2 and elsewhere so far this year. We're seeing machines play an increasingly important role in the corporate world, perhaps as line workers and in forms such as chatbots. We even have been learning about robots designed for personal services, such as companion robots that might cheer us up when we're feeling a little blue. Today, we're talking about the evolving relationship between humans and machines. Michael Schrag is a research fellow at MIT Sloan School's Center for Digital Business and is the author of books Serious Play and Who Do You Want Your Customers to Become from Harvard Business Review Press, and The Innovator's Hypothesis from MIT Press. A few weeks ago, he authored the Harvard Business Review article, How to Give a Robot a Job Review. He dove into the challenges of applying human-oriented standards and expectations to machines. So we're extending that discussion today. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing very well, and thank you for that kind introduction and your interest in the topic, because the post got a lot of feedback, and I like the opportunity to be able to elaborate on some of its themes.
Okay. Hey, before we get into the discussion, let me add a note for the listeners. We welcome your questions and comments on the chat board below, and we'll address as many as we can during the next half hour. So to get the discussion started, I invite listeners to introduce themselves to their peers on the chat board and perhaps, you know, share your own observation on the role of robots and other intelligent machines in our lives. Now, Michael, let me just get things started. What got you thinking about how we will evaluate the performance of robots and other intelligent systems?
The main thing that caused me to explore the notion of giving a robot a job review is the fact that there are two key elements. Number one, that for more and more knowledge workers and people who manipulate symbols and people who manage information, they're more and more dependent upon their technology. And so clearly the performance of their technology is critical to their own performance. And so in a way, when you get a job review now, your bosses, whether it's 360-degree review or a boss review or a performance review, your bosses are effectively reviewing how well you work with your technology. The other aspect, which is key, is that more and more technology is involved in customer touch. Chatbots, ATMs, affective systems, IVR systems. More and more, the quality of the technology determines the quality of the human interaction. Let's not boil this down to dry, flawed metrics. Let's elevate the technology. Let's anthropomorphize the technology and say, hey, you know, we review how humans perform. Let's review how the machines perform as well. Let's take performance reviews and job reviews for smart systems with the same degree of seriousness that we take performance reviews and job reviews for smart people.
One of my favorite points in your article was raising the question of whether we will be disappointed in an autonomous vehicle if it doesn't drive the way we are used to driving ourselves, which is, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 miles an hour above the speed limit.
Speak for yourself, Jim, but yes.
I'm sure there's nobody in uniform listening. Are there currently fair and effective ways to judge a machine's performance?
Well, in a perverse sort of way, you're begging the question, because the issue is, how do we want to review a machine's performance? What kind of expectations should we bring to a job review? There are human beings there are managers, there are executives, you may have had them, who believe that the purpose of a job review is to criticize you. There are others who believe that the purpose of a job or performance review is to motivate you and inspire you. There are others who believe that the purpose of a job review is to give you benchmarks to improve yourself and advice to improve yourself. So even in the existing world of human job reviews, there's a broad portfolio and panoply of options of what a job review and performance review actually mean. You like the example of the autonomous car. You know, for me, it's not, I'm not driving to the airport. It's a taxi driver or an Uber driver going to the airport. And if they're obeying every single aspect of the speed limit, I'm going to miss my plane. Okay? So if the person doesn't speed up, I'm going to ding him on the Uber review in that regard. But let's put this into the chatbot realm. What if a customer is behaving rudely and obnoxiously and using a variety of four-letter words dealing with a robot or a chatbot? Do we want a culture that encourages people to abuse machines and use foul language? Or should we have the civility metric that basically says, this language is unacceptable and we're not going to continue this? Even though I'm a machine, my purpose here is not to process your abuse. That reflects organizational culture. That reflects organizational values. Do you want machine systems to deal with human abuse? Or is your attitude, well, precisely because we have machines there, we can allow our customers to be utter bastards? My argument is we haven't even begun asking these questions, let alone answering them. And here's the reason why it's important that we're doing this kind of an interview, this kind of a conversation. This question is no longer a rhetorical question. It's a real question. It's becoming a real question for organizations in the telecommunications business, in the financial services business. How do we want to segment and treat our customers using smart systems rather than tolerant, well-trained people? That's a multi-billion-dollar question.
Now, that customer using abusive language, now we're talking about an entirely new development project in terms of what of the developers and the organizations knowing what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, and what types of action the machine ought to take. Do they just disconnect the call? Do they move it up to a manager?
Obviously you do. And this, what I'm going to say right now is I'm not going to name the company, but I'm actually involved with an organization, a customer service organization that does this. Right now, the chatbot, if there's abusive or things that are interpreted that it doesn't understand, let's put it that way, the first thing it does is consult another chatbot. It brings another chatbot on there to see if there's a flaw with the existing chatbot or whether the other chatbot has an additional capability to process what's going on. And then you get elevated to a human. And if the human looks at what is a chat exchange, like on an Amazon session, and would see an F word or other kinds of things, then the human being can decide. It looks at it and says, the customer is legitimately frustrated and our chatbots made the situation worse. I'm going to try to smooth over the situation. Or what they realize is they have somebody who's a jerk on the line, and now we have to see what customer company policy is. Do we insist that jerks behave with good manners, or do we indulge jerks? And we could lose a customer. Maybe. Now let's have more fun with this. We see that this jerk has done $1,000 of business with us. Okay, well, then we're going to be nice to them. Oh, this jerk has only done $100 worth of business with us and has done 3 returns already? Unplug. And so now what are we doing? We're creating ensembles of intelligent systems to make determinations about how we treat and interact with customers, with clients, in a smart system versus a human way. Because that's what we're doing now with humans. Why wouldn't we do that with chatbots? Why wouldn't we do that with voice IVR systems? Once you do stuff like that, you're doing job reviews, period.
Yeah. And what you've just described in terms of that customer interaction with the chatbot, that is applying truly human rules. In other words, those are the rules that we have now for a call center.
Exactly. Exactly. But notice something else. I've done work with, by the way, we don't call them call centers anymore, Jim. I'm just having fun. They're contact centers now. Okay?
Oh.
Every single contact center, what do the humans have? They have scripts. You know, we have quasi-autonomous human beings in contact centers because they're acting not just according to principles, but to rules. And certain phrases and certain queries are explicitly designed to trigger scripts. And sometimes there's advice on the tone that you're supposed to use with that kind of script. So we're already in the real, we're already blurring, we're already in a cyborg world. We're already in a world where the in the contact center where we are operating in a part person, part machine domain. And it's not clear whether more value comes from the human or the software. It's not clear. And that blurring is going to become even grayer and more indistinct over the next 5 or 6 years.
All right, let me ask you to do this. Can you give a quick job review to Microsoft Tay and also to the people who built her?
I think Tay did her. Thank you for asking that question. That's the exact right question. Clearly, Tay was encouraged to learn and listen from the environment of which she was a part. Sadly, Tay was not given either the golden rule or the Ten Commandments in terms of how to filter that learning. So as a machine learning exercise, Tay was brilliant. As a machine learning exercise within ethical and civil boundaries, she was a remarkable global failure. For the record, I think this is one of the most important failures in the history of AI. This goes way beyond Weizenbaum's ELIZA, because this was a system clearly designed to learn from the milieu in which she interacted. And what is my takeaway from this? You need to put in some filters. You need to put in some parameters, whether they're rules, whether they're principles, whether there's a conscience or filter, sensor, moderator capability. I don't know. But clearly, how Tay was originally architected, back to the drawing board, folks, back to the drawing board. The blank slate approach doesn't work. You need to have ethical and civil guidelines, boundaries, and rules baked in.
Now, the Tay example led me to write something a few weeks ago about what I've seen over the years in technology, and that is that when new technology is introduced, the key question that everybody asks is, what can it do for us, right? What can it do for my business, with my customers, whatever? Nobody ever asks, what can go wrong?
Oh,
and that's
I beg to differ. In the organizations I work with, people are terrified about what can go wrong. The organizations that I work with tend to take a hardcore microeconomic cost-benefit analysis. Does the benefit of adopting the technology outweigh the costs and the risks? And even though digital media, even though digital platforms, even though machine learning platforms are getting better or cheaper, the Tay example is a brilliant example of underestimating the risk involved in a system that learns divorced from a context of civility, divorced from a context of ethics. Can you imagine Tay as a customer service representative dealing with a distribution, a bimodal distribution of very polite customers and very rude customers? What allows Tay, does Tay do tit for tat with rude and tit for tat for nice? How do we know? My view is this is exactly what the people in your audience should be caring about. We cannot assume away that a learning environment is going to inherently lead to cost-beneficial results as opposed to cost-value-destructive results.
Now, the interesting question from the audience that that has to do with the whole learning process. And that is, Lyndon asks, different vendors' machines will probably be programmed to behave differently. So the job review may be trying to review a moving target.
Yes. By the way, human beings are moving targets too. Absolutely true.
Yep. But also, you know, also
the question we have to ask Lyndon is, do we care? You know, are we going to give the machine more leeway than we give the human? Are we going to, and I'm picking this word deliberately to upset people, are we going to do affirmative action for machines versus humans? Are we on average going to be more forgiving of machines than we are of human beings? Because the machines aren't, quote unquote, as smart or as flexible or as versatile as the human beings. Or should we be harder on machines? Programmed to do. Because they're not supposed to be stupid. They're not supposed to be insulting. They're not supposed to degenerate like Tay. Okay? See, again, these are serious design questions. This was a comedy routine in the year 2000. This is the design argument in the year 2016 for a contact center that has global reach. This is not, again, Jim, what you and I are talking about, this isn't even hypothetical. And the proof of it is Tay.
Yep. And the other thing about coming down too hard on robots, I mean, I think the population, whether they're corporate population or the average person, will fall on both sides. It'll either be too hard or not hard enough. For instance, if we assign a robot X amount of work to do, and they not only do that in 8 hours, but they keep doing it for another 8 hours, we just look at the job getting done. Maybe we don't even credit the robot.
Exactly.
It's like
John Henry versus the steam hammer. You know, John Henry wins, but he dies. But for the steam hammer, it keeps on going. We don't care how hard the robot works. You're exactly right. So now we're discriminating against the robot. Now we don't appreciate the robot. Look at the question you're raising, though. The implicit question that you're raising is we're going to have some human managers who do a better job motivating and programming robots and chatbots than they do human beings. And we're going to have other people who basically do better with humans than with me. So one of the criteria in the job review of the future, of the job review by 2021, is you're going to see somebody, you know, somebody with a master's degree, an MBA with a minor in analytics, and the LinkedIn profile or the profile of this person is going to say, this person does a tremendous job managing smart systems. He doesn't do as good a job with human beings. Keep him managing smart systems. Don't let him manage human beings. Keep him with the chatbots. And who knows? Will get paid more.
Let me throw out the big issue for discussion that comes up so often, and that is machines replacing people. Is the model that machines replace people or machines supplement people? And do the implementers in the corporate world or product development understand the difference?
Well, you know, my colleagues at MIT, Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee, and to a lesser extent, David Autor, you know, there's a huge debate on this. My empirical look at the real world, it basically suggests that there's no question that, especially for so-called knowledge and analytic work, we're going to see greater and greater substitution of technology capital for labor and human labor and intellect. I do think we're going to see new genres of cyborgification and hybridization between man-machine systems. You know, sometimes the human will be used for affect, sometimes the human will be used for thought, sometimes the machine will be used for inspiration, most of the time the machine will be used for pattern recognition and classic analytics or machine learning. It's very, very difficult to project. I think it's going to be a function of the different use case. Some people prefer to deal with machines, some customers prefer to deal with machines, others prefer to deal with humans. So a lot of what you're asking is as much a function of the demand side of the market as the supply side of the market. But I think the safest thing to say is not the false dichotomy of automate or augment, but that the composition of how value is created is going to be more, exponentially more machine and arithmetically less human. That's not to say that the human contribution isn't going to be vital and important and mission critical, but that it will be surrounded or extended by networks of chatbots, robots, and smart software, or and smart apps that may or may not learn.
Now that this whole jobs question raises a point that I've thought about for quite a few years now, and that is a lot of the jobs that get replaced by machines aren't jobs that other people want to really do. And in my own profession, you know, in journalism, we're now seeing robots writing, you know, earnings results,
right.
and press releases. There are other things that most journalists would rather be doing than writing up predictable earnings results that basically met what the company said they would. You know, and when there's an aberration, that's when the human steps in and they follow up. Same with Roomba. You know, if you don't have to vacuum your floors, you know, that's not a bad thing.
I agree. The flip side is, but, you know, I take markets seriously. My background is economics and computer science. Yes, we no longer need a J school grad or a communication school grad to write either the earnings press release or the earnings story with a quote, with the obligatory quote from the CEO, an external investor, some shareholder, and some Wall Street analysts. Agreed. The question then becomes, are the other stories, the human rights, of enough interest, of enough value, entity, a firm, a newspaper, a newsletter, a magazine that can economically afford to pay for that kind of work? And that is, as somebody once said, beyond my pay grade. But I think there's absolutely no question that the more structured, the more formatted, the more explicit the genre of story, narrative, analysis, spreadsheet, etc., the more susceptible it is to a machine learning chatbot, smarter software system that minimizes the need for human oversight or intervention. And then let's be blunt, to use your phrase, then the human beings really are in the anomaly detection business rather than the journalism business or the comms business.
Yeah, and the question of whether the newspaper or website, whatever, pursues those follow-up stories, really, it comes down to their core business model. It doesn't really have to do with automation.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And with all due respect, and I say this as somebody who used to work for the Washington Post, which, of course, is now owned by who? Jeff Bezos and Amazon. I would not, if I were a smart financial investor, I would not be putting my retirement funds into newspaper stocks.
No. So a few of us have learned that lesson. How do you reply when you hear people talk about smart machines getting out of hand? You know, that, you know,
the
1950.
Elon Musk notion, you know, I, for one, salute our robot overlords. You know?
Take it back to the 1950s. We've always been, you know, threatened with, you know, robots taking over the world, and it hasn't necessarily happened, other than in select applications. And you know, what would it take for a robot to really be
I am
get out
going
of control?
To say, I loved Isaac Asimov growing up. loved Robert Heinlein growing up. I can quote you the three laws of robotics. But I will say that for the foreseeable future, and I will define the foreseeable future just to be on the safe side, with all due respect to the Ray Kurzweil singularity crowd, I'll define it going up to 2030, that I am more concerned about human malevolence than machine intelligence wreaking havoc through digital platforms and internets of things, what have you. I do not rule out the notion that we will have a machine learning system that is that there will be a K counterpart to Internet of Things that leads to a horrendous crash of some real world, network that runs some sort of mass transit system or factory or building or what have you. But the reality is that, in my opinion, the reality is human beings have a better track record of being vicious bastards than machines. And I'm going to stick with my kind in that regard.
Well, that human, the evil side of humans lead certain people to develop machines that do threaten the rest of us?
Such that is yes, but let's turn it around. I also believe that one of the things we will see with anomaly detection and machine learning systems are systems that, just as we have right now, we are using machine learning systems to detect hackers, to do intrusion detection, to begin to explore hackback options, to begin to profile people who would do harm to others. And so I think we're entering a digital arms race empowered by machine learning systems to identify and preempt bad actors at the same time that bad actors are looking for ways to use our own systems to hurt us. So that's the arms race of the future. I take that back. That's an arms race we've already entered. And I don't know how it's going to evolve, but I can say with firsthand knowledge, there are a lot of real smart people all over the world addressing both the good and evil side of those equations.
Now, one thing that we are seeing with machines right now is there are applications where the machines are actually doing good. And what they are doing, for instance, look at some of the iRobot technology that's being used in war to go into buildings to disarm bombs or detonate bombs and so on, saving lives. And we're starting to see it now. We see it in robotic surgery.
Exactly.
What has really impressed you? What would you say, as we're approaching the bottom of the hour here, we've got about 2 minutes left. What has really impressed you? In terms of innovation,
the thing that has impressed me is the rise of algorithms that facilitate unsupervised learning in data set ensembles. And so we have a mixed market of machine learning where we have human-guided, supervised data set machine learning and unsupervised, and we can do checks and balances in ways of seeing what unanticipated paths are discovered by human perception and what serendipity emerges from machine pattern recognition. I am excited by the increased, and I'm picking this word deliberately, the increased diversity, the algorithmic diversity around machine learning, machine intelligence, and applying that to create and manage value and signal that value to human beings more effectively. So, yes, I'm going to end by saying I am more of a techno-optimist. And because I'm a techno-optimist, I think we should have the guts to give machines job reviews.
I like the idea. And it's going to be, Michael, this has been a great discussion. I think we're still in the early stages of the human-machine relationship. And it's going to be fun to watch over the next few years as things unfold. You know, there are going to be some more Microsoft Tays out there, and there'll be a lot of applications that you don't even know are using machine learning.
Couldn't agree more.
It just works.
I'm, like yourself, I'm eagerly awaiting Tay 2.0.
Michael,
Jim.
Thank you so much. I want to thank Michael Schrag of the MIT Sloan School of Management for being with us today. And thanks to all of you for joining us. This has been Jim Connolly for All Analytics Radio and UBM Tech. I want to thank our sponsor, SAS, for these programs. Thank you for tuning in. And Michael, thanks for sharing your thoughts. Enjoy the rest of your day.
And to you.
Thanks.
Jim, you happy?